This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And yes, this is Brooke Spector, and with The Deep Dive, as we are every week at this time. And today, we're going to shift a little bit from some of the programs in the last couple of weeks, which have been more in terms of cultural activities and how they impinge on society. And here we're going to do a bit of a deep dive right into the hardcore of foreign policy. For all of you folks who've been waiting for this one, here we go. Okay, in recent weeks, a major element of discussion, anger, annoyance, about South Africa's foreign relations have been focused on just how the country should prioritize its relations with Russia within the BRICS community and much nearer to home, the many crises on this continent, the African continent. One important intersection, of course, is the food crisis that has now been exacerbated by the recent cancellation by the Russians of the Black Sea Grain Initiative that had allowed Ukraine to export its grain to hungry countries and to the World Food Program. Another, of course, is how countries like South Africa should respond to Russia's use of the Wagner Group in various nations, such as the Central African Republic and some other countries in the Sahel. And then there is the economic relationship between South Africa and the United States and with Western Europe that seem in contrast or contradiction to the government's very sympathetic stance towards Russia and China. And for those of you who are wondering, none of these points actually speak directly to a near civil war that's taking place as we talk in Sudan. And then just yesterday, yet another coup on the continent in the country of Niger. And of course, the perennial challenges of a free, fair, transparent election in neighboring Zimbabwe. And helping us work through this collection of questions, we don't have 5 hours to do this, but we'll do the best we can. We're joined by Lawrence Karumba, a researcher at MISTRA. MISTRA means Mapungubwe Institute for Strategic Reflection. Its origins were some of the thinking folks within the ANC who gave birth to an institution which isn't a government institution, it's not a party institution. It has a sympathetic feeling toward both, but it's independent, and so are its researchers and writers. And Lawrence has a master's degree in political science from the University of Pretoria, and he is now a PhD candidate, just awaiting the final stamps of approval, apparently, in international relations from the University of the Free State. And his research focuses on the use of cyber operations and online propaganda as tools of foreign policy by various states. Now, there's a topic we could do another time, I think, because this one is never going to go away. Very recently, he was a co-author with Abba Yaakov Omar, who is the operations director for MISTRA. The book was Reflections on Africa's Place in the World, which came out 2 months ago. He's had a long experience for such a young man, it seems. He lectured at the University of Johannesburg and at Monash, South Africa. He's been an analyst for the Thai Embassy in South Africa. He's been a researcher at the University of Pretoria Center for International Political Studies, and he's written pieces for the Mail and Guardian as well. Now, I was reading some of his writing, and I came across an article that came out last year in September in City Press, I think it was. And let me just read a short paragraph from it. When South Africans think about foreign policy, to the extent that they think about it at all, we usually end up fixating on global rather than regional issues. We argue about what stance the country should adopt toward Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the Israel-Palestine conflict, the question of whether South Africa should provide aid to Cuba, and so forth. These are, of course, important questions, some of which have a material bearing on South Africa's national interests. The Russia-Ukraine conflict, for example, has directly affected South Africa's inflation rate and food security. But the harsh reality, however, is that South Africa does not possess many foreign policy tools that can use to influence these issues one way or another. So that sets up kind of a challenge. A lot of things to be interested in, not so much muscle to have effect. So you have to pick and choose your fights or your efforts or your interventions or your exertions. With that, let me just welcome you, Lawrence. I'm glad you could join us this morning.
Thank you very much, Brooks. Not such a young man, unfortunately, anymore, but it's really nice to be here on the show with you.
Well, you're younger than I am. Let me put it to you. Everybody's younger these days. Take me through this argument that you have, which I'm not sure I disagree with, but through it for the benefit of listeners, that there are all these things to consider, but because the country cannot legitimately and realistically punch above its weight very much or even at its weight sometimes, how does one make these decisions and what are the consequences of this?
Well, the punch above its weight thing is actually an interesting one because it's a common sort of phrase that you hear a lot in sort of foreign policy circles in South Africa. That's an interesting discussion that we can have about whether South Africa can or does punch at or above its weight. But I would say that I think you've given a good summary of the argument here that we were trying to make in our recent book that we published on foreign policy at MISTRA. I think South Africa is obviously an African power, right? Its interests are predominantly African interests. And on the one hand, this might seem kind of obvious. It might even seem like a bit of a cliche. You know, you read government statements on South African foreign policy. It's one of the first things that every foreign policy document will start off by saying, you know, well, South Africa is an African power. Our interests are in Africa. But I really want to make the point that this isn't just a slogan. This is something that we can sort of prove empirically, scientifically, right? In international trade, you know, we have the most most accurate scientific model that we have of international trade is the gravity model, right? Which actually, it predicts international trade better than some of the more well-known theories like comparative advantage. I mean, what does the gravity model say? Basically that countries will trade with other countries that are nearby, right? And also are big. So it's almost inevitable. Geography has this kind of iron impact on our economic relations where we are forced to have our most important relationships are going to be with the countries that are nearby. And in addition to that, we can look at issues like international migration, for example. You know, when, you know, Europeans, for example, tend to believe that international migration from Africa is just like people leaving Africa and trying to go to Europe. But of course, the vast majority of migrants in Africa migrate to to other African countries, right? Many, many migrants to South Africa. When there is a war or insecurity or conflict, right? The countries that bear the highest consequences for that are always the countries that are most nearby. And so again, you know, it's an empirical fact that South Africa's interests are always going to be predominantly, the things that will directly affect us the most are the things that are happening closer to us, right? Again, I mean, does that mean that we do not have, that there is no consequences from something like the war in Ukraine for South Africa? You know, no, obviously, as I said, I mean, these things affect us quite a bit. But, I'll give a framework here for thinking about these issues, right? The U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower, right, Supreme Commander of World War II, you know, very accomplished guy in all sorts of ways. I mean, he had this little tool for thinking about how to prioritize issues, which is like the Eisenhower matrix, right? Like you sort of create a grid of four squares. And on the one hand, you have kind of high priority issues versus low priority issues. And on the other hand, you have like issues that I can influence versus issues that I cannot influence, you know, and if we apply that to South Africa, something like the Ukraine war would probably fall into issues that are important for us, but which we have limited tools to impact. Whereas things that are happening in like Mozambique, for example, we have both interests at stake and we also have tools to influence those. So I would probably say that that's where our priorities should really be focused on.
Let me make you stop right there just for a minute. We have taken an ad break. Got to pay all the sponsors. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we're speaking with Lawrence Karumba of MISTRA on international relations and South Africa's challenges thereof. And we'll be right back after this message.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is the Deep Dive, and we're Brooke Spector, of course, and we're having a conversation with Lawrence Karumba of Mistra, and we're talking about South Africa's international relations, and he's laid out a model of things you can affect versus things you can't, things that are high priority, things that aren't quite so high priority, and trying to figure out what fits where. And from that, I will infer that what you're saying is that the things that are high priority and the things you can affect are the things that should get most of your attention, as opposed to the things that are low priority and you have no effect on anyway. And so what does that mean in practical terms, in real world terms, as opposed to a nice model in a textbook?
Sure. Well, I mean, if we look at something like the Ukraine conflict, for example, South Africa's official stance has been a policy of non-alignment. And I mean, in terms of the model that I've laid out, I think I would say that a strategy of non-alignment on the Ukraine conflict is one that makes sense for us, right? That this is not an issue that we can reasonably do a lot about. And so it makes more sense to sort of try to avoid alienating either side as much as we possibly can. I wouldn't necessarily say I have some criticisms of how South Africa has implemented that, you know, that model of a non-alignment strategy in practice. And I would point to maybe other countries like India, for example. You know, India was sort of a pioneer of the strategy of non-alignment during the Cold War. And I think if we look at India's approach to the Ukraine conflict, we can kind of see that it's done a fairly good job of managing to kind of avoid alienating either side. And actually, it's managed to, in the midst of this conflict that's taking place globally, it's managed to extract a lot of benefits for itself, for its own interests, from both sides. Whereas South Africa's interventions seem to have, get the feeling that we've sort of alienated and caused a lot of distrust, both, especially from the West. And I'm not sure that we've gotten a lot of concessions from Russia in return for our strategy. So I would say that, you know, the model that I'm laying out would say that a non-alignment strategy would be sensible for us, but I think that we could do a better job of implementing it in practice.
If I could try to clarify that a little bit. You're arguing that the Indians have engaged in a masterful version of real politic behavior. No permanent enemies, but always permanent interests, as some British statesman said 200 years ago. And, versus a high-minded, principled, highly moral foreign policy that a late president of South Africa once advocated. And South Africa managed to be sort of neither one nor the other in the process, making annoying people in every direction and getting very little in return.
I'm not sure I would accept the characterization of South African foreign policy, but I would accept your characterization of Indian foreign policy. Look, let me talk a little bit more about this comparison, because I think it's an interesting one and it deals with the BRICS, right? Like, if we're looking at real politics, let's consider something like India's policy of buying discounted fuel from Russia at above the price of the market cap that has been set by the EU, right? Now, what does this do? From India's point of view, it gives a lot of benefits because it means it gets cheap fuel, which it benefits its interest in economic development, right? From the European perspective, it's a little bit annoying to them. I mean, it means that India is in some sense funding the Russian war effort in Ukraine, right? The West would obviously prefer that that not be the case. However, the West can also see that although India is buying fuel from Russia, they're buying it at below market rates. So in some sense, Russia's financing for its war effort is still lower than what would be the case if they were selling it at market rates, right? Like, Russia's kind of losing out on the deal. And then we can look at it from Russia's point of view, and we see much the same thing. I mean, Russia would obviously prefer to sell at market rates, but at least they're getting something. So although both Russia and the Europeans end up getting slightly annoyed with India on this, they can kind of understand why the Indians are doing this, and they're sort of okay with it because it's at least better from their perspective than the alternative. And India wins out, right? And they manage to maintain good, they manage to maintain good relations with both sides, and they get a whole bunch of cheap fuel in the bargain. And I think that also other countries kind of maybe they respect that because Indian foreign policy is seen as being predictable. It follows self-interest. When we compare that to South African foreign policy, I think that there are many aspects of South African foreign policy, especially on the Ukraine issue, that seem confusing and unclear to the rest of the world. And I think that that sense of confusion maybe inspires distrust because other countries are not quite sure what South Africa's motivations are. And that makes it difficult sometimes for other states to engage with us. You know, I mean, we could go on, but we could look at things like, you know, the Lady R incident, where it's still not exactly sure what was going on or what South Africans' motivations were. There's a lot of opacity, shall we say, that surrounds that.
I was going to be particularly uncharitable and say you could argue that the South African response to the invasion of Ukraine has been not only unpredictable, your word, not only confusing, but internally inchoate, that there are conflicting interests that it has been unable to resolve. And as a result, you get what we see now. You get the effort to have a peace negotiation team of African leaders in the two countries, Ukraine and Russia. But at the same time, you don't get a strong-minded, vigorous response to the closing of the Black Sea grain route. And you find the South Africans curiously unable to pronounce the word invasion most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, the Black Sea grain deal is a good example of an issue where Russia was really in a position to make concessions that would benefit South Africa's interests, right? And obviously, they chose not to do so. So, you know, I do think we find ourselves in this position, this unfortunate position, where as a result of our friendly-ish relations with Moscow, we are at risk of losing economic benefits from the West, you know, in the form of things like AGOA and possibly, you know, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, under which, you know, South Africa receives preferential trade terms from the United States. Those, and I think other programs that Western countries have that benefit South Africa, I do worry that we're putting those at risk. And then, like I say, if we look at the Black Sea grain deal, it's not clear to me that South Africa has received significant concessions from Russia either. This is what I say, you know, I would contrast a kind of a non-alignment policy where we're getting benefits from both sides, whereas, you know, with a non-alignment policy where we're getting benefits from neither side, worry that we're heading in that direction. And you are correct, by the way, that there are internal disagreements within the South African state as well. I mean, obviously have, you know, I have no inside knowledge about what goes on inside the government, but just looking at public statements, it feels to me as though there are real differences of opinion on this between the Defense Department, which has taken a very kind of strongly pro-Russia stance in all of this, versus things like, you know, the Treasury and Trade Departments, which are trying to sort of maintain good relations with the West. DERCO is kind of stuck somewhere in between. The presidency is trying to balance all these different issues. And it's hard to know sometimes exactly what's going on behind the scenes.
Part of this, I think, and this is my conjecture, because I don't have any more inside information on the squabbles or disagreements or gentle arguments in the union building team, but somehow it seems like there is an argument between real benefits versus symbolic benefits.
Maybe. I mean, I do, you know, so I think what you're sort of alluding to is the, you know, this perception that there's an ideological link between the ANC and the Russian government that kind of goes back to the Cold War and the struggle against apartheid. That is one, you know, there's a sort of ideological explanation for South African foreign policy. I think that there is, I mean, personally, I tend to think that we can usually explain foreign policy better by looking at, sort of concrete national interests. And I think there are ways in which decisions that were made by Western powers, right, in the post-Cold War era, you know, looking at things like the war in Iraq, the NATO intervention in Libya, has kind of alienated states of the you know, like the so-called global South, right, South Africa in particular. And so there has been this move to say that, look, you know, we want a world with more multipolarity. We want a world with more representation for states such as ourselves. The problem, though, is that, well, so the problem, though, is that not all of the calculations on which that is based are necessarily correct. So, like, there's this idea taken root, I think, that we're in a period of U.S. decline and the rise of China, and that, you know, like, the sort of, the one part of the world is moving up and the other part is moving down, and I'm not so sure that that is actually true anymore because, sorry, the percentage of the world economy that is accounted for by the U.S. has actually grown since the 2008 financial crisis. So I think that South Africa could possibly gain more in terms of its national interest by balancing better between the West and, you know, the sort of the global South faction, whatever you want to call it, like China and its allies, rather than sort of aligning too closely with China and the BRICS.
I mean, I agree with the general point you're making. In fact, South Africa runs a trade surplus with the United States and manages to actually import value-added products like automobiles and leather car seats, and highly processed agricultural commodities. And you see virtually none of that going to China. China buys a lot of commodities, rocks dug out of the ground, basically, without much value added, and runs a trade surplus with South Africa, to which it exports lots of finished goods and services. And the Russians are basically a rounding error in the whole question anyway, because the amount of trade between South Africa and Russia is, you could ignore it and it doesn't matter much. And you could ask rhetorically, what does Russia export besides oil and natural gas? And the answer you put your hand up for is weapons. And that's about it. And if all of those are true, and if you are putting aside all those sentimental values about the third world or the rising of the South, you go after where the money is to be made.
But also, I would say, and look, I mean, this kind of brings us back to the point where we started, right? The issue of South Africa as a state within Africa. One of the things that I do worry about is that if you kind of chart like a long-term trajectory of South Africa's foreign policy in the post-apartheid era, you start to see that from about 2000 to 2010, right? We have South Africa really focused heavily on Africa as a region, right? South Africa is a creator of things like, the African Union and, you know, NEPAD and these various other institutions. We're sort of positioning ourselves as the leader, right? From 2010, South Africa joins BRICS under President Zuma, right? And we start to see this real shift, I think, away from a focus on South Africa's core African region.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we're speaking with Lawrence Karumba of MISTRA on international relations and South Africa's challenges thereof. And we'll be right back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive, and we're Brooke Spector, of course, and we're having a conversation with Lawrence Karumba of MISTRA, and we're talking about South Africa's international relations. the viewpoint, the vantage point, the way in which the world was seen from Pretoria, from solving or dealing with or coping with problems of Africa or its issues arising on the continent, and shifting toward this larger worldview that's a function of being a BRICS partner from about 13 years ago to the present. Now, my argument would be that's partly the reason why there is this muddle, or there is confusion or internal disagreement about South Africa's place in the world. In a funny kind of way, and I'm just going to toss this out here, you shoot me down if you will, this is of an echo, of a distant echo of an argument about Africa, about South Africa's role internationally, either within the larger British Commonwealth and dealing with wars well beyond the African continent's origin, or focusing on the near and close that raged, oh, probably up through till about 1939, 1940.
Yeah, with the under Jan Smuts, basically. Right, and there are, and of course, you know, we know that Jan Smuts, of course, was unseated by the National Party, in part because there was this perception amongst white South Africans that he was too focused on international affairs as opposed to domestic issues. And I think we saw interesting echoes with that under the Mbeki administration as well, you know, where, you know, that one of the problems that he faced was this perception that he was this jet-setting president who was too focused on issues abroad. There's real potential domestic costs for being too focused on foreign policy. And I think that is actually part of the reason why we saw this changeover, right? Although it might be kind of in the opposite way that you're thinking. Let me make an argument, right? So in the early 2000s, Thabo Mbeki was president of South Africa. South Africa's economy was growing. The ANC was extraordinarily dominant within South African domestic policy. And Mbeki had a lot of political capital that he could spend to negotiate deals and focus on improving the African continent, right? From the 2008 financial crisis onwards, we start to see Jacob Zuma becomes president. The South African economy stops growing, but internationally, South Africa is invited to join BRICS. So we start to focus more on BRICS as our main kind of avenue for foreign policy rather than the African Union. I'm sure that people in the South African government would disagree with this formulation, by the way. I have no doubt they would say that, no, we don't see a trade-off between BRICS and the AU. But I mean, anyone who's worked in an organization knows that you have limited bandwidth, right? There's a limited amount of funding. There's a limited amount of meetings that you can be doing in one day. And I think it's clear to me that South Africa's focused more of its energy and its attention on BRICS than on African issues since 2010.
There's an article in this comparing the current question with a distant one in the past.
Yeah, well, this is the problem with being a writer. There's articles on so many more things to write about than you have time of the day. But yeah, so the thing with BRICS, right, is that South Africa is far and away the smallest power in BRICS. I mean, when South Africa joined BRICS in 2010, we had, I think something like South Africa accounted for 3.5% of the entire GDP of BRICS. Since then, that's declined quite a bit. So I think we're now at somewhere between 1 and 1.5% of BRICS GDP. In the one sense, South Africa is part of this bigger, more important group of countries that collectively has a lot of say on the international scene, right? Conversely, however, our level of influence within BRICS is smaller than what it would be within an organization like the African Union, for example. But also, I would say that if we wanted to work on African issues, the issues that need to be dealt with in an African continent require the government to make real compromises and political concessions. Like if we're going to focus, like my preferred foreign policy, right, would be one where we focus on things like African trade, African investment, and African migration, and try to strengthen those strengthen cooperation on the continent on those issues as much as possible. Like, to me, that would be beneficial for the continent as a whole, and it would be beneficial for South African interests, right? I strongly believe this. However, those issues would require South Africa to make compromises in terms of its domestic constituencies. You know, things like free trade is controversial. You know, international investment is controversial. Migration is unfortunately extremely controversial. You know, there's issues with xenophobia in South Africa, and we can see that in the context of things like the European Union, for example. It's been one of the main domestic challenges that countries want to participate in the EU. They face domestic opposition on these issues related to migration and trade and so on. I don't think that in the, you know, sort of from post 2010 onwards, when South Africa has had a lot of problems domestically, I don't think that the government wants to make those domestic trade-offs, right? The government's worried about its own domestic position. And BRICS doesn't force us to make those trade-offs. Like, nobody's talking about a BRICS free trade area. Nobody's talking about allowing free migration from the rest of BRICS. It's a big organization that gives a lot of prestige, we could say, but it doesn't force the government to make trade-offs between its domestic interests in the same way that these other issues do that personally I would prefer to focus on.
It strikes me that you set out one of the very first of all, trade protection and immigration are the standards by which almost every country on the planet now has to confront with their domestic constituencies, and they do it badly for the most part. Be hard pressed to point to a country that gets that mix right. But as to the point about BRICS doesn't force these kinds of hard choices, the old adage in American politics is, when a president is confronted by domestic crises and issues that can't be solved, they take a foreign trip and they, you know, they conduct international relations and they visit China or something like that, because they're more influential, and the domestic constituencies, historically at least, didn't have the same impact. Now the two sets of things merge more than they used to, too. I could have easily seen a domestic constituency crisis in this country over trade if we were talking about textile workers and textile factory owners, but that whole interest group has almost vanished once trade restrictions on importation of cheap fabrics from East Asia disappeared back in the 90s.
Yeah, if we're looking at the issue of trade, right, I think that this is where the African continent has really made the most progress in the form of the African Continental Free Trade Area. And this is probably the most important development in African politics, like really since the formation of the AU itself. But it's worth noting that South Africa was not really one of the driving forces behind this. You know, like South Africa and Nigeria, the two biggest economies on the continent, kind of had to be dragged into this free trading system by the other African states.
We're speaking with Lawrence Karumba of Mistra, and we're talking about South Africa's foreign policy choices and trade-offs and just how difficult it all is. I'm Bruce Spector, and this is The Deep Dive, and we'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Bruce Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Bruce Spector, and we're speaking with Lawrence Karumba of Mistra, independent think tank, and we're talking about South Africa's foreign policy trade-offs. That they're difficult. They're not easy. They're not just straightforward. You don't just make a pronouncement and things all go well. In fact, they don't always go well. And as we, just before we took the break, Lawrence was speaking about the way in which Nigeria and South Africa had almost to be dragged into the discussion for an All Africa Comprehensive Free Trade Association because presumably, domestic interests in the two countries.
Certainly in Nigeria in particular, there was a lot of fear about being exposing domestic producers to competition from other African states. And I think that the process of passing this was a little bit easier in South Africa than in Nigeria. It does kind of show the practical challenges, you know, that we can sit down and we have this sort of nice pan-Africanist rhetoric about how, you know, we want to work together and we want to improve the fortunes of the continent collectively. And I think we should want that because because I said at the beginning, Africa's fortune really does impact us. Things that happen within our own region are intrinsic to our own interests, but it can be difficult to get things past these, it can lead to domestic interests that are worried about foreign competition. And then, you know, when we start to get from, I mean, trade in some ways is one of the easiest. If we get to issues like migration, for example, this becomes enormously politically challenging to tackle. But in my view, I think that we should because, I mean, it's clear to me that the existing system of migration is not working. You know, we sort of build these high walls, we set up these barriers, and then we just have huge amounts of irregular migration that we can't keep track of. And I think all economists who have really studied the issue would say that, yeah, actually, you know, intra-African migration ends up benefiting, it ends up economically benefiting all sides. So, you know, you get these difficult issues that are hard to deal with. And like I say, I really wish that, you know, to the extent that South Africa is going to make these hard choices about what to sacrifice, I would prefer that we focus on those sorts of issues rather than, you know, expending political capital, getting involved in controversies over, you know, like Russian ships and things like that. I mean, to my mind, those are a non-core interest that South Africa should stay away from.
Let's turn to a practical question, taking your perspective, focus on the continent, its issues, they're closer. They have a possibility of causing great harm as well as some actual tangible benefits. And go about 1,000 miles north to Sudan, or 1,500 kilometers or thereabouts, in which there is a dreadful virtual civil war taking place. It's got everything going on now. It's got internal and external migrants. It's got destruction of an economy. It has the possibility for breakaway regions to fight over resources. It's sort of like the model. If you want all the problems all in one place, there it is right now, right in front of you.
Yeah.
What could South Africa do realistically, either individually or within the context of the AU or in some other form? What's South Africa's leverage point or impact?
South Africa is not in a position to, you know, to carry out some sort of far-ranging intervention, especially at such a far distance. Yeah. And this is sort of one of the points that I've been kind of hitting at here is, you know, this importance of geography and this importance of proximity. So we can talk about the African region as a region, and it is, but at the same time, a country like Sudan is very different, is very distant from South Africa. I mean, it's closer to certain European countries like Italy, for example, than it is from us. And so just in terms of like things like force projection of military forces in terms of, strategic airlift capability, like we do not have the ability to go and fly our forces to Sudan and sort of stabilize the situation. However, you know, we do have influence within multilateral organizations like the African Union. We can act as a kind of, you know, we can help to sort of break the coordination problem of getting everyone together to sort of pool their resources. We ourselves could not be part of, you know, we would not necessarily be like taking the sole role or the lead role in such an intervention, but we can contribute our resources and help to pull together some sort of intervention to say, look, what are the tools that we have? Our diplomacy, maybe the levers of economic statecraft, the military forces that we have, you know, what are the resources that we as African states can kind of pull together to, create more incentives for to try to create more incentives for cooperation rather than conflict in this region. So it's really like South Africa's role as a coordinator. I think that is what we should be leveraging.
We'll get a little closer to home then. There's an election coming up in near neighbor Zimbabwe, and there have been charges over the years that the election was neither free, fair, and certainly not transparent, and then the winner doesn't end up winning. What can South Africa do now? And the history of South Africa's involvement with Zimbabwe's electoral process is not all that salutary, given the various examples of its engagement. What should it do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the issue of South Africa and its response to Zimbabwe's political problems, I mean, this has been sort of an ongoing kind of point of controversy and pain in South African foreign policy going all the way back to like the late 1990s. And especially when we look at a country like Zimbabwe, here we can really see that there are real national interests at stake, right? Like to the extent that there is instability or infighting within Zimbabwe, it causes refugee flows into South Africa, it harms the South African economy. The thing is, though, the actual levers that we have are still somewhat limited. I mean, South Africa can certainly, you know, we can take a position, we can condemn what we see as abuses of the democratic process. We can and should, I think, avoid giving our stamp of approval to elections that are illegitimate. You know, so I do think that South Africa should take a stronger stance on that. Beyond that, foreign policy is a difficult problem because, you know, we're dealing with issues outside of our own borders where our ability to kind of change the world to fit the way that we would like to, the way that we would like it to be is just inherently imperfect, unfortunately. But yeah, I would like to see South Africa take a stronger stance in favor of democracy.
Unfortunately, time is against us and we're going to have to close up on this. We've been speaking with Lawrence Kurumba Mistra, an independent research agency, research institute, really. We've been talking about South Africa's place in the world, South Africa's place in Africa, and the way those two circles do not necessarily evenly and effectively intersect. It should give us a sense of limitations, a sense of realism, and just maybe a sense of respect for the inability to affect the world easily by just punching that button and making things happen. And with that, this is Brooke Spector, and I'm doing the deep dive with Lawrence Kurumba, and we'll be back again next week with another conversation on another issue of interest and importance to South Africans. Thank you for listening.